Hello and welcome to the Atavist Magazine podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Evan Ratliff. The Atavist Magazine releases one true blockbuster cinematic story each month at magazine.atavist.com and sometimes as a podcast. So with Halloween fast approaching, we wanted to bring you our own version of a terrifying story, The Ghosts of Pickering Trail. It's the portrait of a family ravaged by grief and driven to the edge by inexplicable events in their home. Here's Will Hunt and Matt Wolf, the authors of the story, with a true tale of one family's harrowing ordeal. You'll hear both authors reading, starting with Will.
The Ghosts of Pickering Trail by Will Hunt and Matt Wolf. In the spring of 2006, following a long illness, Frank Milliken died in his home. His family, his wife Janet, and their two children, Ryan and Kendra, took the death hard. For 3 years, they'd watched Frank slowly waste away from pulmonary fibrosis, incurable disease that causes the lungs to thicken and scar, blocking the flow of oxygen to the blood. In the last months of his life, the illness had confined him to his bedroom. After his death, the character of the Milliken house seemed to change. Physically, it was the same. A big, comfortable rambler in Concord, California, with a red tile roof and a copse of fruit trees in the backyard. But the house felt different. After Frank passed away, the memory of his death lingered. Janet took the kids to a hotel for a few days, but when they returned, it was no better. Months went by and their grief persisted. Ryan, who was 14 years old at the time, was a talented baseball player, but he quit the team and began failing classes. Kendra, a vibrant, popular girl 2 years her brother's junior, drew into herself. Janet began to worry that her children would be unable to heal in a place that reminded them constantly of their loss. A year after her husband's death, Janet Milliken flew to Pennsylvania to look at properties. Her sisters lived on the East Coast, and a new house on the other side of the country, Milliken reasoned, would offer her family a fresh start. Eventually, she settled on a stately, four-bedroom colonial in Thornton, a small town outside Philadelphia. She made an offer of $610,000, and the sellers accepted. On a warm, late summer day, the Millikens moved into 12 Pickering Trail. Milliken was proud of her new house. It sat at the apex of a cul-de-sac in a quiet, affluent subdivision, a suburban Arcadia whose residents kept their doors unlocked and their lawns flawless. The house had a beautiful new kitchen and a large backyard, bordered by woodland where Ryan and Kendra could play. A few days after moving in, the previous owner, a local man named Joseph Giacono, dropped by to ask Milliken if she needed anything. Milliken had been having trouble with the hot water, so Giacono helped her adjust the water heater in the basement. As they walked back upstairs, Giacono made a strange comment, a comment, Milliken would recall some years later, that seemed to come out of nowhere. Giacono said that the people who had owned the house before him had had a terrible accident. A firearm had been involved, and now three children, he told her, were orphans. Milliken felt the hair rise on the back of her neck. She thought about asking for details, but didn't. One afternoon, not long after, Milliken introduced herself to an older woman who lived in a nearby house. The neighbor shook Milliken's hand warmly, welcoming her to the neighborhood. "We're all surprised that you bought it," the woman said, giving Milliken an odd look. As the woman walked into her house, her comment hung in the air. Milliken noticed that the house attracted a strange sort of attention. On Halloween night, she was standing on her front steps when she spotted a group of girls in costumes rounding the sidewalk outside her house. "That's where that thing happened," one girl giggled. The group moved on without stopping for candy. Milliken was growing increasingly anxious. Around this time, her family began to experience a series of strange, unsettling events that defied easy explanation. The first incident, as Milliken would later testify in a deposition, came several weeks after moving in. One afternoon, she was visiting her sister Jill a few towns over when she received a call from Ryan, insisting that she come home immediately. He was still upset when she arrived. Ryan said he'd been doing homework in the kitchen when he felt someone breathing on his neck. He'd turned around and seen a man's dark shadow move in the hallway. He had searched the house but found no one. Milliken hugged Ryan and told him that what he had felt was probably just air from the vents. Privately, she resolved to find out what was going on. Soon after, Milliken knocked on the door of a neighbor, a divorced mother of two named Yolanda Gary. "Did something happen in my house?" Milliken asked. Gary started to cry. "We We thought you knew, she said. The two women sat down on Gary's front lawn, and Gary told Milliken the story of the last family to live at 12 Pickering Trail.
The Kumbulis family, Gary said, were good neighbors, though they kept to themselves. They declined to participate in the neighborhood's Labor Day parade and watch the fireworks display from their front steps, apart from the crowd. Konstantinos, a restaurant owner, and his wife, Georgia, had been 12 Pickering Trail's first occupants. They had purchased the house in 1993, just after it was built, and raised three children in it, two boys and a girl, as well as nine cats and three dogs. The children rode bikes in the cul-de-sac. Yolanda and Georgia grew close, and Georgia confided that her marriage was troubled. By the end of 2005, the couple were sleeping in separate rooms, and Georgia was speaking with an attorney about divorce. On the morning of February 11, 2006, neighbors awoke to the sound of gunshots. When police arrived, they found Georgia and Konstantinos dead in the master bedroom. Georgia lay on the floor, shot in the face and back. She was fully clothed but barefoot, suggesting that she'd been attacked while dressing. Konstantinos lay on the bed, a pistol in his right hand. Yolanda walked outside to find news trucks and police cars filling the cul-de-sac. After a brief investigation, police ruled the deaths a murder-suicide. The Kumbulis' 11-year-old son, a police report noted, had walked in and witnessed the incident. The children were sent to live in a Greek Orthodox orphanage. The animals went temporarily unclaimed. For days, neighbors heard them howling in the vacant house. Over the next 6 months, the property sat empty. The deaths had traumatized the neighborhood, and residents were eager for a new family to move in. Finally, in September 2006, the house went up for sale at auction. It was purchased by a local family, the Jaconos, for $450,000, significantly less than the price of comparable homes in the area. The Jaconos spent 9 months renovating the house and put it back on the market at a 40% markup. Several weeks later, Milliken came from California and placed her bid. Gary was still mourning the loss of her friend Georgia when the Millikens moved in. She had hoped new neighbors would help her move on. The night after Gary told her what happened, Milliken lay awake in her bed thinking about Ryan and Kendra. She had taken them 3,000 miles across the country to escape a house haunted by death. Her new house was supposed to be a refuge. Instead, she had delivered them into a house with an even more difficult history. The only thing to do, she decided, was move. At first, Milliken was hopeful that she would simply be able to give the house back. After all, when she showed her home in Concord, she was legally required to inform interested parties of her husband's passing. One buyer, in fact, backed out shortly after making an offer, citing the death as a deterrent. But when she contacted the Jaconos, they refused. Milliken consulted a local lawyer, Timothy Rain, who specialized in personal injury lawsuits. Rain thought that Milliken had a pretty good case. What jury couldn't feel sympathetic towards a grieving widow raising two children? Moreover, Rain knew that Pennsylvania law requires sellers to disclose a property's major defects. Failure to do so would mean that the sale of the house could be rescinded. In November 2008, Milliken filed a lawsuit against the Jaconos in the Delaware County Court of Common Pleas. Her request for a jury trial was denied, meaning Milliken would not be allowed to take the stand in the court. Arguments would be heard only by a judge. Meanwhile, in preliminary motions, the Jaconos' attorneys pointed out that Pennsylvania law requires the seller of a house to disclose only material defects, things like water damage or termite infestation. What was material about the memory of a murder, they asked? And what proof was there that a grisly past could even affect a house's present value? Surely lots of old houses had had deaths occur in them. The Kumbulis property was no different. What the Jaconos had failed to disclose, essentially, was a ghost story. In early 2010, when court proceedings had dragged on for a year and a half, Milliken received a phone call from Rain, who said that he knew of someone who could help them. He'd found a real estate expert with an odd kind of specialty, appraising properties where murders and other horrific incidents had occurred. He'd worked on cases like this before and was willing to fly out to advise them. His nickname, Rain said, was the Master of Disaster.
In 1992, a young real estate appraiser named Randall Bell bought a house in Laguna Niguel, California. Shortly after Bell and his family moved in, the house, a spacious four-bedroom Tudor with sweeping views of the San Joaquin Hills, began suffering a series of minor domestic catastrophes. First, the soil under Bell's home expanded, fracturing the foundation. Next, the slope of the west side of his property began a slow, gravitational creep, pulling down the hillside. Environmental hazards sprang up. A nearby sewage treatment plant announced that it would expand its foul-smelling facilities, while the local military base proposed a plan to accept commercial aircraft, creating a new flight path for jumbo jets directly over Bell's home. Finally, one morning, Bell was awoken by a small earthquake and walked outside to find a large crack in the shallow end of his pool. Bell was not alone in his distress. Around that time, all of Southern California, in fact, seemed to be under assault. From his front steps, Bell watched wildfires incinerate the El Dorado National Forest and Laguna Beach. Up the coast, in Malibu, heavy rain caused rivers to overrun their banks and flood homes. In the orchards of Bakersfield, a cold snap wiped out the citrus harvest. Earthquakes rattled the San Fernando Valley. A landslide in Anaheim Hills forced dozens out of their homes. A sinkhole even swallowed a well-trafficked swath of Hollywood Boulevard. For several years, Bell had worked at a small appraisal firm where he evaluated mostly single-family homes and subdivisions. He was planning on moving into real estate development, where friends were making fortunes. As the damage piled up, Bell, a tall, handsome man with sandy blonde hair, tan skin, and an almost pathologically easygoing disposition, began getting calls to appraise some of the properties disfigured by these disasters. Rather than abandon his profession, Bell decided to stake out a new specialty. "I called all my clients and told them that I wasn't going to appraise normal stuff anymore," Bell recalled. "It had to be damaged." Bell found that he enjoyed the challenge of putting a price on deeply imperfect things. As he traveled around the region, he marveled at the abundant variety of misfortunes that could befall buildings and land. In addition to natural disasters, he inspected properties crippled by settler threats, like groundwater contamination, asbestos, oil spills, landfills, power lines, dam failures, and freeway expansions. To aid his appraisals, he searched for an authoritative book on the evaluation of damaged real estate. When he discovered that the topic lacked a definitive text, he decided that he would write his own. An obsession took hold. For months, Bell made a routine of tucking his three young children into bed and retiring to his office, where he compiled a long list of every bad thing that could sap a piece of real estate of its financial value. He then organized these hazards, which he termed detrimental conditions, into categories. Within a year, he had created a rubric that placed each type of mayhem into one of 10 classifications. These range from Class 3 market conditions, like a recession, to Class 8 environmental conditions, like the presence of mold, to Class 9 natural conditions, like earthquakes. Each bore its own unique methodology for valuation. This way, an appraiser confronted with a damaged property could refer to the chart and find the means to properly assess it. Senseless chaos could now be organized and, more importantly, priced. In the summer of 1993, Bell unveiled the list at a conference for real estate appraisers at Disneyland. He summed up his findings in a simple chart that he called the Detrimental Conditions Matrix. The appraiser community found Bell's innovation immensely useful, but disliked the title. They called it, simply, the Bell Chart. Bell's client roster multiplied, and his name soon became synonymous with the strange field of study that he had effectively created. A few months later, Bell was able to leave his job and start his own appraisal firm. Not long after, he received a phone call from a man named Lou Brown, who needed help with a condo in West Los Angeles. Brown's daughter, Nicole, and her friend Ronald had been stabbed to death on the condo's front walk. Nicole's ex-husband, O.J. Simpson, stood accused of the murders. Bell, like the rest of the country, had watched the trial coverage for months. He had seen the condominium on the news so many times that he could picture its facade in his head. Brown wanted badly to sell the property, but all the media attention had made it toxic, and he couldn't find a buyer. He needed Bell's advice. Soon after, Bell and Brown drove to the condo, ducked under the yellow police tape, and inspected the grounds. Bell found the scene surreal. He was struck by ordinary household objects that the sensational nature of the case had invested with a bizarre aura. On a ledge near the garage, he noticed a ring left by an ice cream cup Nicole had eaten on the night of her death. Beside her bathtub, he saw half-melted candles. He stood for a time on the walkway, scrutinizing the tiles. The condominium was unlike any property Bell had ever evaluated. There was nothing physically wrong with it. It was, by all appearances, an attractive, well-maintained residence in an exclusive neighborhood. And yet, walking through the house, Bell could think only of the murders. The property's damage couldn't be seen or touched, but it was real. The idea of someone living there seemed impossible. When Bell sat down with Brown, he could see that the condo was a painful reminder of his daughter's death. How, Brown wanted to know, could he get it off his hands? Bell thought about what made a property repellent to buyers. He realized that most people had developed a negative impression after seeing the condo and countless stories about the murders. If he could alter the condo's appearance, thus blurring its picture in the mind's eye, that connection might diminish. So, at Bell's suggestion, Brown replaced the building's much-photographed facade, added trees, planted flower beds, even swapped out the street number. It was the same location, but the small aesthetic differences rendered it unrecognizable. It took another 2 years, but the condo eventually found a buyer, though one who paid well below the asking price. After the condo sold, Bell parked near the property and spent several happy hours watching perplexed tourists walk up and down the street, trying and failing to find the house they'd seen so many times on TV. The real estate industry has a term for properties with histories that make them difficult to sell, psychologically stigmatized. Bell realized that these kinds of properties must be everywhere. A well-publicized murder, a mass shooting, a bombing, a group suicide, would almost always taint its surroundings. An appalling act adhered itself to local architecture, clinging to surfaces like an odor. It transmuted schools and homes and businesses into mnemonics for trauma. If a memorial is a place where death is collectively recognized, a stigmatized property is a place where death remains raw and unprocessed. Looking at the world, Bell began to map a dark archipelago scattered across the planet, to which new islands of violence were added every day. Bell's work on the Brown condo was mentioned in the Los Angeles Times, and the national press, desperate for a fresh angle on the trial of the century, pounced. News stations from all over the world contacted him for interviews. Soon he was receiving calls from other people trying to sell houses that had been the site of murders, which in turn led to requests for more interviews. The media was fascinated by Bell's work, and Bell's laid-back charm played well on television. Over the next 15 years, Bell traveled all over the world, dividing his time between massive disasters and lurid scenes of tabloid horror. He examined such famously stigmatized properties as JonBenet Ramsey's house, the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, the nuclear weapons test sites of the Bikini Atoll, businesses looted and burned in the Rodney King riots, the California estate where actress Sharon Tate was killed by followers of the Manson family, Chernobyl, the Rancho Santa Fe mansion where 39 members of the Heaven's Gate cult committed suicide, the field in Pennsylvania where United Flight 93 crashed, and the World Trade Center. For around $400 per hour, Bell would advise sellers on how to price their stigmatized property or make it more attractive to prospective buyers. Bell's firm of three partners is based in a 1930s beach cottage located at the base of a vertiginously steep canyon that suffers regular cave-ins and dry weather fires, an intersection Bell calls a disaster paradise. On his desk, he keeps a coffee mug emblazoned with the words Master of Disaster. Behind him hangs a large black and white photo of a mushroom cloud blossoming over the Bikini Atoll, between pictures of Bell's kids. One morning in 2010, Bell was in his office drafting a report for one of his appraisals when the phone rang. The call was from a lawyer in Pennsylvania, asking Bell if he could consult on a house.
Thanks for listening to The Ghosts of Pickering Trail by Will Hunt and Matt Wolf for the Atavist Magazine. This is episode 1. Stay tuned for episode 2 and episode 3. This podcast was edited by Megan Dietry. The story was edited by Katya Bachko and fact-checked by Aviva Stahl. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Atavist Magazine, and you can find us online at magazine.atavist.com.